Today is November the 14th, 2018. For the month of November 2018, there are 5 Thursdays. That means that Thanksgiving comes early this year. Next week is Thanksgiving Day, and the day after that is Black Friday. Just remember, the best deal that you're going to get on Black Friday is not buying something you don't need. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. If you have any questions for us, just send us email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. Do we need a wallet-sized form factor smartphone? Samsung and a few other companies have been releasing oversized smartphones, referred by some as phablets. Because of their large size, some users have found them to be uncomfortable to use. Many people do want a larger size screen, and that brings us to the present. Samsung introduced the Galaxy F, which features an OLED screen, which folds in half like a wallet, and then a second OLED panel on the outside so the Galaxy F can still be used when it is folded shut. Does the world really need a smartphone that can fold in half so it can be stuffed into a pocket? Well, we're about to find out. Smartphones are featuring new technology like a fingerprint sensor, a brand new camera system with as many as 5 cameras, and a fresh new all-screen display design with a hole cut for the camera instead of a notch. Samsung and Huawei has been in a race to see which company can be the first to show off a foldable smartphone. They both ended up losing when a no-name brand from China showed off a foldable phone last week. That phone will never make it to most markets, though, leaving Samsung as the first company to show off a smartphone with a folding display that will actually be widely available. The 7.3-inch foldable screen makes the Galaxy F more of a tablet than a smartphone, and it has a custom user interface that Samsung and Google reportedly created especially for this device. In order for most people to even consider taking the Galaxy F seriously, it'll need serious developer support. But the design of the Galaxy F has a physical drawback. For one thing, the device will be large when it is folded in half. The Galaxy F is obviously expected to be about twice as thick as the normal flagship phone. Beyond that, Galaxy F is expected to be incredibly expensive at a cost of $1,770. That's a lot of money. Now it's important to put all this in perspective. This is what phablets look like when they first hit the market. It's a first-generation device that is big, bulky, and expensive. It will fit in your pocket, a big pocket that is, but it's not going to be comfortable. Instead, it would be too thick and too heavy. And of course, don't try sitting down with a unit in your back pants pocket. But if there's indeed demand, the Galaxy F will pave the way for foldable smartphone designs of the future that will be thinner and probably a lot more sleek. But if there's no demand after a few years, well, it'll become a part of trivial history. The smartphone business has been the introduction of new models with short product life cycles, which in turn results in constant stream of smartphone sales. Over time, the buying public will not be interested in the latest and greatest at unaffordable prices. The high-end smartphones are approaching $2,000. That's $2,000 of net income. I have a beef with class action lawsuits. The U.S. Supreme Court justices in an internet privacy case involving Google disagreed over whether to rein in a form of settlement in class action lawsuits that awards money to charities and other third parties instead of people affected by the alleged wrongdoing. The $8.5 million Google settlement was challenged by an official at a Washington-based think tank, and some of the court justices shared his concerns about potential abuses in these awards, including excessive fees going to plaintiffs' lawyers. Some of the justices emphasized that such settlements can funnel money to good use in instances which dividing the money among large numbers of plaintiffs would result in negligible per-person payments. A California resident filed a proposed class action lawsuit in 2010 in San Jose federal court claiming Google's search protocols violated federal privacy law by disclosing users' search terms to other websites. A lower court upheld the settlement where the company agreed to pay in 2013 to resolve the claims. Critics, however, have said that the settlements known as CPRAE awards are unfair and encourage frivolous lawsuits, conflicts of interest, and collusion between both sides to minimize damages for defendants while maximizing fees for plaintiffs' lawyers. Supporters have said these settlements can benefit causes important to victims and support underfunded entities such as legal aid. The three main plaintiffs in this case receive $5,000 each for representing the class. Their attorneys received about $2.1 million. Under the settlement, the rest of the money would go to organizations or projects that promote internal privacy, including at Stanford University and the AARP, a lobbying group for older Americans, but nothing to the millions of Google users who the plaintiffs were to have represented in the class action. CPRAE Awards, which remains rare, gives money that cannot feasibly be distributed to participants in a class action suit to unrelated entities as long as it would be in the plaintiff's interest. Justice Alito raised concerns that the money would go to groups that some plaintiffs might not like but have no say in opposing it. Chief Justice Roberts noted that AARP engages in political activity. Roberts also said it was fishy that settlement money could be directed to institutions which Google already was a donor. Justice Kavanaugh noted some beneficiary institutions were also the alma mater of lawyers involved in the case. Justice Ginsburg said that at least the plaintiffs get an indirect benefit from the settlement. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor added that it seems like the system is working. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said each of the 129 million U.S. Google users who theoretically could have claimed part of it would have received a paltry 4 cents in recovery. That's 4 pennies. During the argument, several justices, both liberal and conservative, wonder whether the plaintiffs had suffered harm through their internet searches sufficiently to justify suing in federal court, signaling that they may dismiss the case rather than deciding on the fate of CPRAE settlements. Class action lawsuits, the only winner in all cases are the lawyers. Is it the Christmas spirit or is it really competition? I think it's competition. What am I talking about? Competition for online holiday shoppers are heating up, and Amazon announced that it is offering free shipping with no minimum purchases for orders that will arrive in time for Christmas. And as previously reported, Amazon's competitor Walmart announced it will expand its free 2-day shipping options in November. Millions of additional items on its website sold by third-party sellers will qualify for the free 2-day shipping perk. Well, those are the big two. Hey, wait a minute, there's another one. Target also announced it would offer, for the first time, 2-day shipping with no minimum purchase this holiday. The offer starts November 1 and it ends December the 22nd. Competition brings out the best in companies. Wait a minute, competition brings out the best prices from companies. The following are a composite of technical questions received in our email bag. A listener asked if he could downgrade Windows 10 to 7 on a newly purchased system. First, a little background. Why did he want to take a brand new system installed with the latest version of Windows 10 and have it downgraded? There are two classes of application programs. Most of us are familiar with commodity software applications. This is the type of software that is widely available from many suppliers, and it is targeted to a wide audience, meeting a wide variety of use. An example of this is Microsoft Office. Then we have vertical software applications built to support a specific function and or process that are unique to that user group. An example of this is a tax preparation program. Then we have some vertical application programs that are very specific to an industry, like to dentists, doctors, in other words, people running their own small business. A listener asked if he could downgrade Windows 10 to 7 on a newly purchased system because he had a vertical software application for the visually impaired that will not run on Windows 10. It was an XP application. He was able to run it on Windows 7 in XP compatibility mode. It was a simple two-step to set up installation. That is to say, properties followed by selecting the XP compatibility tab. That was easy. With Windows 10, you have to navigate through and test up to 10 separate points to find if the XP program can run in Windows 10. Even if the program runs, Microsoft issued a disclaimer that the program may not necessarily run without problems. So he decided to downgrade the operating system. The listener purchased a new system and had anticipated the ability to run this specific vertical application on Windows 10. But he couldn't find the XP compatibility mode in Windows 10, and at least he thought there was none. Well, there is XP support, but it's not direct, nor is it clear cut. You have to navigate through and test up to 10 separate points to determine if the XP program can run in Windows 10. Why didn't Microsoft just make it so that instead of stopping at up to 10 separate points, you just go right through it and not to require the user to step through? Another related question from another user is, Windows 7 is no longer sold. He can download a copy of Windows 7, but he needs a product code to install it. If you just need the software, you can still buy Windows 7 software in shrink wrap. Well, how do you get it? Well, it's called OEM Windows. How is it different from the retail version of Windows? You may already know that OEM stands for Original Equipment Manufacturer and the hardware or software to be used in the end product of some other company. Technically speaking, Microsoft is an OEM as its Windows operating system ships on PC manufactured by companies like Dell, HP, Lenovo, and others. Well, there are ways of testing if the XP application can run in Windows 10. You go through the initial steps as you would in Windows 7. You go to Properties, right-click on it, and instead of an XP compatibility tab, you would run the tab that says compatibility. And it pops up with one of two choices. Check, check. And it brings you to a page where you just press another key to say Run Compatibility Troubleshooter. And that brings up a selection of one of two steps. Try recommended settings and test the program. Another one is troubleshoot the program. Well, if you try the recommended settings and you test the program didn't run, then you go to troubleshoot the program. Or I think that you could skip that by just going straight to troubleshoot program to see if it works. But when you hit that, you have another four different options to choose from. The program worked in the earlier version of Windows but won't install or run now. Another option is the program opens but doesn't display properly. Another one is the program requires additional permissions. And the fourth one is none of the above. I don't see my problems listed. As you have to navigate through up to 10 separate points just to test the application, if it is XP compatible at all, instead of requiring you to step through one step at a time, Microsoft could have made it much easier by having a straightforward test. I've gotten a number of queries on how does one find an older version of Windows operating system to reinstall onto the computer. The state of the operating system they have became so corrupt they need to reinstall it. They had either misplaced the distribution CD or eliminate a hidden partition that contained the distribution copy of the operating system. On the Microsoft website, only the latest versions of Windows 10 are available. There is a website that has all the different versions of Windows 7, 8, 8.1, and 10 available for download. It's www.windowsiso.net. That's windowsiso.net, one word. The downloads are free, and the ISO files can be easily set up so that you can install from them directly. You're out of luck if you needed Vista. One person asked where he can get a copy of Windows XP to reinstall onto his ancient system. I suggested he look at what's available from distrowatch.com. These operating systems will run more securely and efficiently than Windows XP. The only downside is if you need to run a standalone, offline version of a tax preparation application on the Linux system. That is still a missing factor in Linux. You can run tax preparation programs online with either Linux or the Chrome operating system, but not all forms are readily available for processing online. And Dr. Alfred Paul will be presenting in the Wearable and Health Technology segment, What is Interactive Life Insurance? Beats me, I don't know. I'll find out. He'll cover consumer concerns about data security, and he will talk about a new skin patch sensor. I hope you like it.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Let's start off with a story that you may have heard about a month or so ago. John Hancock is one of the leading life insurance companies in the country, and they announced that they were no longer going to write traditional life insurance. From now on, they were only going to sell what's called interactive life insurance. Now, just what the heck does that mean? Well, what it is they use exercise data to help provide incentives for their policyholders to be more active and to be healthier. The program relies on data that is entered by the user, or it can also take data from wearable devices like fitness bands and smartwatches. Now, when this news came out, a lot of the headlines said, oh, everybody's got to exercise. Everybody's got to wear a fitness tracker if they're going to have John Hancock Insurance. Well, that's not exactly the story. The fact is that what's happening is John Hancock is paired with a company called Vitality. And what this does is it provides incentives for policyholders to exercise and live healthier. But there's no requirement that you submit any exercise data in order to have your life insurance policy. It's just if you do, you can get discounts on your insurance premiums, you can get bonuses, you can get discounts on other devices and things that you shop for. And this program run by Vitality, they've discovered that it really does help improve the lives of the policyholders. Some of the results that they've had so far, people who participate in the Vitality program, they live 13 to 21 years longer than the rest of the insured population. Let me say that again. 13 to 21 years longer than the other policyholders. That's a pretty good incentive for John Hancock because that means they get to collect premiums for an extra 13 to 20 years before they have to pay out. So it's a big financial incentive for them. In general, the program also showed 30% lower hospitalization costs than the rest of the insured population. Again, these are benefits that go straight to the bottom line of the insurance company. They find that the people who participate take nearly twice as many steps as the average American. They've logged more than 3 million healthy activities, such as walking, swimming, biking, and so forth. And the big part here is they're engaged with their life insurance policy on average 576 times per year, compared to the typical life insurance policy when you don't even think about it except when you pay the premium. So it's not a requirement that you exercise. You don't have to turn over your exercise data to it, to the company. But if you do, again, you can get discounts on things that you would buy as a consumer from different products. You get discounts at hotels and so forth. So it's an interesting marriage of the digital data from exercising and a way to encourage the policyholders to be more healthy, which in turn benefits the life insurance company. And I want to point out that this is yet another data point that underscores one of the themes that I keep banging on over and over again. The future of wearable devices is not with individual sales to individual consumers who are exercise enthusiasts or want to get more fit or whatever. The bottom line is that these devices are going to be bought and used by companies who will see a financial benefit from their use, a direct benefit in their profit and loss. And that includes insurance companies like John Hancock. So this is not some crazy off-the-wall kind of program. This is something that clearly showed benefits already. This kind of encouragement and incentive to help people live healthier lives is going to benefit us all. On the subject of personal health data, there's a lot to talk about there as well. One of the growing concerns for consumers is who's got their data and what are they doing with it. The whole concept of data security is becoming much more important for the average consumer. Unisys, the big data processing company, they've been doing annual reports about consumer concerns over all kinds of security. They've been doing it since 2007. And this year, the report shows that consumers are most worried about things like identity theft and bank card fraud. These are more of a threat to them, in their mind, than are disease epidemics or terrorism or even natural disasters. Identity theft and bank card fraud, those are the things that they're worried about the most. The study also shows that consumers are concerned about how their data is used. Police being able to track a user, their location, simply by the fitness band or their smartwatch that they're wearing, doing that without the wearer's consent is not acceptable to most consumers. Consumers are also concerned about health insurance companies being able to monitor your exercise and other activities. Now, there's one interesting exception to all this. The majority of consumers, almost 80%, decided that they like the idea of a medical device that will send significant health information to doctors when there's a need for them to be notified, when something is different and could signal a significant problem that needs attention right away. In that case, they're fine with people being notified on your behalf automatically if you're having a health problem. Consumers also like the idea of being able to summon emergency assistance simply by pressing an emergency button. And they also like the idea of a luggage sensor that could automatically notify them when the contents were removed from the luggage. So presumably, if you were traveling and you didn't know that your suitcase was being tampered with, it would notify you. So the bottom line here is that people are getting much more cautious about what kind of data is used and how it's used and who gets to use it. But the good news for the health tech industry is that consumers are comfortable with sharing their medical data, their health data, especially when that means that they may be able to have disease identified faster, that they can get treatment faster, and that they'll have better outcomes much sooner. And speaking of sensors and medical data, one of the big problems with post-operative patients is the need to monitor their condition, monitor their biometrics to make sure that they're not having problems and complications after the surgery. There are all kinds of devices, external devices that you can hook up with attaching wires to the body and so forth, but those are hard to use when the person's not just stuck in bed. When they're up and walking around, it can be tangling, it'd be awkward to use. You have to carry the device with you, and it's a problem. Some companies have made small sensor patches that you can attach to the skin, but still, these have limitations. They can be uncomfortable, and even though they're small enough to wear under your clothes, you can still feel that you're wearing them. Well, researchers at Purdue University have created what they call a smart sticker. And unlike many of these smart tattoos and similar devices, most of them use a plastic substrate. This, however, uses a cellulose substrate. The film that the sticker is printed on is made out of cellulose, which has the advantage of being breathable. So it can attach to the skin and be stretchable, but it can breathe and it doesn't feel as intrusive or bothersome. According to the studies that they've done so far with the prototypes, patients don't even notice that they're wearing it. The advantage is that it stretches and contracts and moves just like human skin. So there's no pulling or restraint by wearing the sensor, and it can wirelessly send information. Now, one of the very interesting things about this is that the device is made out of biocompatible materials, which means it can also be used possibly as implantable sensors. So you could put it directly on internal organs or inside your body and other places and provide constant data readouts about different kinds of biometric measures that you'd want to be able to track in a patient. And perhaps in the future, when you go to the doctor's office, he'll be able to send a file to a 3D printer and have it print out a custom-made sensor patch just for you that you can put on your skin and use it to monitor whatever is necessary to keep track of your current medical condition.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Preventive hardware maintenance of computing equipment. We've been inoculated in the media about the importance of what we eat and drink. The food we ingest has a direct effect on our physical health. Similarly, the care and preventive maintenance of the computing hardware we use will operate more efficiently and we will be able to lengthen the product life cycle of the hardware. With personal computing, there is the hardware maintenance and the software maintenance of a computer system. Preventive maintenance refers to regular, routine maintenance to help keep equipment up and running, preventing any unplanned downtime and expensive costs from unanticipated equipment failure. Include hardware preventive maintenance as a procedure whenever you change the clock in the spring from standard time to daylight time, and in the fall from daylight time to standard time. Computers these days are so reliable in general that we pretty much just ignore the question of whether the surrounding environment is one in which the computer can and should operate. Especially when talking about an office environment, we usually just assume that if we're okay to be in the room, then the computer's probably fine as well. That's not a terrible assumption to start with, but there are some exceptions. If you want your equipment to last a long time and perform well, then taking environmental factors into consideration is actually something you should do. The hardware maintenance of the equipment is to run the system CPU within the range specified by the manufacturer. In general, the internal elements of the CPU has an outer operating limit of 35 to 80 degrees Celsius or 95 to 176 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the best CPU temperature? Don't let your CPU run too hot. The CPU is the processor inside your computer that's responsible for most of the day-to-day number crunching. In short, it's the part that does most of the work to make Windows and applications run. You should consider the operating range of 45 to 70 degrees Celsius or 113 to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, the absolute minimum and maximum for long periods of operation. When it senses the extreme temperatures, the CPU will shut down to prevent any damage. This is temperature operating inside the CPU and not outside of the CPU casing. You have other electronics that are affected by temperature extremes, such as memory. Back in the 1980s, when I operated a bulletin board network, I located the equipment in a spare room where there was no heat or air conditioning. The system froze up when the room temperature dropped below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Most people will not have to worry about cold temperatures when operating the computer, but heat is a common problem in the operation of a computer system. Before the CPU shuts down, it will run slower and slower and slower. You may wonder why, when you are running the system in a room that is comfortable in temperature, that this can happen. The fan dispersing the heat inside the system unit may not be functioning properly. Most users do not realize dust builds up inside a desktop system unit as well as inside a notebook. Some are running tower systems. To not clutter desktop space, many opt to place the unit at floor level. This placement attracts more dust at this level than the desktop. Another factor are those who have pets at home. Pet hair accumulation around the fan will cause the fan to rotate at much lower RPM and in effect not be able to cool the CPU unit. Use a vacuum carefully to suck out dirt and debris or blow out the dust with a can of compressed air. If you're using compressed air, try not to blow the dust back inside the system unit. If you are able to open the desktop system unit or open the notebook to access the inside, the dust cleaning would be a simple task. The placement of a system unit should have spacing where the fan can blow out. Backing it against the wall would inhibit the fan to be effective. With desktop units, you also have connecting cables. Make sure they are not bent to a point where it's not making good contact with the connecting ports. The ideal temperature is as cool as possible, which usually means room temperature. Since a hot running CPU could cause problems ranging from unwanted system crashes to physical damage to the process itself, you can keep it cool by controlling fan speeds. Another item you should check periodically is a surge protector. The surge protector protects against sudden electrical spikes. When it happens, it will render the surge protector to be useless unless the surge protector can be reset. If you see the light blinking on the surge protector, it means it's time for a replacement or you need to do a reset on the surge protector. If you live in a city like New York where there is rolling brownouts during the summer to prevent a total power shutdown, it is recommended you connect your equipment to a UPS battery backup unit. Prices have fallen sharply for this equipment. Units are available for less than $40, which is not that much more than a surge protector with reset feature. A brownout is an intentional or unintentional drop in voltage in an electrical power supply system. Intentional brownouts are used for load reduction in emergency. The reductions last for minutes or hours. The irregular power supply during the brownout can ruin your computer and other electronic devices. Electronics are created to operate at specific voltages, so any fluctuations in power, both up and down, can damage them. A UPS with voltage regulation can prevent any damage to equipment. Most modern CPUs, including AMD, have a protection feature that automatically shuts them down if they get too hot, so that actual damage is unlikely. You can check the specifications of your particular CPU, which details the maximum operating temperatures for many processors. How does one check CPU temperature? Download the program HWinfo by doing a search using the following syntax. Download space HWinfo. That's download space HWinfo. This program is free and it does very detailed hardware monitoring. It will monitor the CPU temperature, speed of the fan, and the life of the battery in the notebook. Temperature is very easy to dismiss because most of us don't think about it when it comes to computers. We just assume it doesn't matter when in fact it does. As long as you know when and when not to operate a computer based on temperature, you should be, well, A-OK. Also bear in mind that all computer hardware and laptops has specifications that state minimum and maximum operating temperatures, and they're usually 100% accurate, and it needs to be observed. There is a class of Windows PC notebooks that are very low priced. In fact, one of them is the Dell Inspiron 3000 that is available during Black Friday for $120. These units are equipped with only 32GB of flash memory storage and 2GB of RAM memory. I had purchased one of them 2 years ago. The unit came with Windows 10 Home. The 32GB of storage is very limiting. When new, I managed to squeeze 9GB for data storage. I use it for making presentations and for testing new application programs. Over the 2 year period of ownership, Windows 10 has gone through a number of upgrades. Each time it has happened, the installed size of Windows 10 get incrementally bigger and available data storage space gets smaller. I have installed a 64GB micro SD flash card and moved parts of the OS and data to it. With a little shuffling of the Windows Home operating system, I have managed to install Microsoft Office, Kingsoft WPS Office, Audacity, and a number of small utilities onto the system. It's a nice usable system and it's portable. You may ask why I don't just add more memory and swap out the flash storage for greater capacity. The gotcha is the memory and the flash card memory storage is soldered on and not replaceable. If you think you're doing more than access to the internet and processing email, then look at Windows notebooks with real data storage capacity and read the specs carefully, in which the data storage and the RAM memory is removable for upgrades. Buyer beware. Marty Winston sent me a segment titled Up on the Rooftop. I got excited. Hey, is he going to be talking about the Drifters? No such luck. Marty likes to talk about reducing energy costs overhead in an energy miserly house. Well, how about going all the way overhead to the roof? How much does it fend off heat or cold outdoors from getting into the house? How does it do that? What about noise? We know some roofs are noisier than others. What's going on to last a long time? Regardless of the weather, and what will stress the house less? What will be, Marty? Shingles or thatch? Wait a minute. I have a flat roof.
Today's segment is about roof, justice, and the American way. Or at least the first part of that. Roofs. But like everything else about your house, it's complicated. A roof isn't all there is to the lid of a house, and covering the house isn't all there is to a roof. Before we get through, we're going to get into hot air, hot water, hot sun, wet rain, cold snow, and more than most people know about how icicles are born, and why that's a bad thing. If you think of a roof as just a sheet, we can start there. It's a sheet made of shingles, or tiles, or shake, or metal, or maybe something else. When the sun shines, it's shade for the house, a literal parasol. When rain falls, it's an umbrella. When there's a hailstorm, well, it's a drumhead. When there's snow, it's a weightlifter. When there's a tornado, you hope that it isn't a flying carpet. But it's not just a sheet. It's one layer of a small ecosystem that involves the skies above and your house below, and that's not all. I'll get into things like roofing types and gutter systems in a few minutes, but I want to start with a particular problem that prevails in snowy climates. Technically, it's called an ice dam. Notably, it's the reason that icicles hang like stalactites from the edge of the roof and your gutters. I'm starting there because it's a great example of how a roof finds itself in the middle of many forces and factors. So, to start, think about a pitched roof, you know, one that's angled, not flat. Think of it after a snowfall that's been big enough and in temperatures that are low enough, cold enough, for some accumulation of snow to remain on the roof. Very picturesque, right? Snowy roof surrounded by snowy branches on the trees and little clouds showing when you exhale. If it was a nighttime snow, the day may be warm enough to melt it, and it all turns into the sound of water flowing through your gutters and downspouts. Clean and simple, right? But what if it's not quite warm enough for the snow to all melt? At that point, we should remember that heat rises, and we should talk about your attic. If there's a lot of really good insulation blanketing the ceiling of your attic, maybe 8 to 9 inches of closed-cell polyurethane foam, the temperature in your attic won't get through to your roof. But what happens without that insulation? Absent that insulation between your attic and your attic can heat your roof. Think of it this way. If you could put a pail of water in your attic in the winter and not have it freeze, you're headed for some challenges. The floors below your attic radiate heat upward. Heat rises. Heat that gets through the attic floor, and it takes more than rolls of that fluffy fiberglass stuff to stop it. If you have exposed ductwork in your attic, or any ductwork short of the double wall insulated kind, your ducts are heating your attic too. Exhaust vents can heat it, so can lighting fixtures in the ceiling below, so can your chimney, especially if you use your fireplace. Those sources of heat all rise to the highest altitudes of your attic because heat rises. So It's the roof just above those places, along the peaks and the ridges, the high points of your roof, where the heat from below, from inside your attic, is most likely to start melting that rooftop snow. Following it so far. While heat rises, water falls. The water from the melting snow will head down the slopes of your roof, underneath the snowpack there. It's when they get to the edge of the roof, that water melt gets to the edge of the roof, right at the eaves, where the real trouble begins. All the way down, underneath that snowpack, the water is cooling. Some will stay liquid and drip into the gutter, or miss the gutter and drip onto the ground. Some of that may form icicles. Yes, that's how those icicles are born. But the most significant freezing happens right at the edge of the roof. Think of it as a horizontal icicle. It may start small, but it acts like a wall, and it levels up to its immediate height. However tall it is right that second, it will hold back some of the snow melt water behind it. It's ice. It holds back water behind it. So by definition, it's a dam. Pretty obvious now why it's called an ice dam, but the worst is yet to come. That water behind it starts to freeze. It makes ice. And that ice is now climbing back up the roof. As it does, it can lift shingles. When that happens, some of the water can get into the roofing board, into the attic, into the walls, into the ceilings, and into some really big ticket repairs. That could leave you unhappy that you chose to shingle your roof. Well, what if it isn't shingles? Or what if you have a water barrier between your roofing board and your shingles? Well, those can help. But skipping that mold and mildew planting season scenario, there are other ways for damage to happen. Did you buy discount gutters? How big do the icicles grow at your house? Pretty big, huh? How much would you guess one of the biggest ones might weigh? What happens to your roof when that much weight is right at the edge? What happens to your gutters? I think you're starting to see why ice dams are worth some attention. There's the cost of repairing roofs, the cost of replacing gutters, the cost of replacing walls or ceilings, the cost of dealing with mold or mildew, a lot of little things like that. Ha ha ha, you say. You saw some heating wires in a zigzag that they said you can place at the lip of your eaves and they're supposed to be able to stop ice dams from forming. Caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. When I hit the search engines to look into those, I saw too many photos of those zigzag wires above giant icicles with some scary structural damage behind them. Something else, too. If your roof is shingled, those heated wires can make the edge shingles brittle. So, yeah, you can add yet another bill. In an earlier segment, I talked about having 8 to 9 inches of closed-cell polyurethane foam insulation added across the entire underside of the attic ceiling because that little change could cut heating and cooling energy costs by 30% and reduce the wear and tear on your HVAC system. So your HVAC then can run a longer time without needing a major repair. It also helps keep, think about this, the high points on your roof, those places that got warm, it helps keep them from warming. It helps keep them from starting the ice dam cycle. So now you can add a major reduction in ice dams as to how to dodge roofing and gutter and maybe other expensive repairs. Well, enough about ice dams. When I say roof, what do you think about? Do you think about the first thing up top that the rain and snow will hit? Have you ever thought about what's between that and the sheathing boards that kept the house before the roof went up there? Do you think about the ceiling of the attic space, which is the underside of the roof? Do you think about insulation in the attic space? These are all elements of the layers that create a roof. There are several kinds of roofing, as you know. You may not know all of them. It started with straw thrown over the top to mud and straw roofs that the Vikings used to make, to thatch roofs, to roofs made of nothing but canvas or fabric, or roofs made of planking, or roofs made, well, more contemporarily. Modern roofs tend to involve, more than anything else, asphalt shingles. Asphalt shingles have a life expectancy of anywhere from 5 to 20 years, depending on, well, more factors than we have time for me to list right now. Does your roof have asphalt shingles? When's the last time you replaced it? When will you need to replace it again? Take a look at it. What condition is it in? Shingle roofs are among the least expensive modern alternatives, and certainly for a pitched roof, it is the most popular. That's not the only choice, though. There are slate roofs, tile roofs, metal roofs, and more. And every one of these roof types gets some kind of bad rap or another. People associate metal roofs, for example, with noise when it rains. That is seldom true for any more than minimal tin roof style roofing. And when it comes to tin roofs, well, like you, I prefer the kind that's made with chocolate sauce and peanuts. But raised metal roofing has seen rapid advancements in technology and tends to last for more than half a century. They're very wind resistant. They won't lift in anything short of a direct tornado hit. And they are very good in most current designs at the task of shedding heat from the sun. Still, like many kinds of roofing, their overall thermal efficiency will depend more on what's underneath them than on what they're made of or how they're made. Depending on the design of the metal roofing, it may work best with an air gap underneath. For some other kinds of metal roofing, an air gap is inappropriate and can weaken the roof. Do what you have to do. Ask an expert. That's what you have to do. But what about other roofing styles? Tile roofs, shake roofs, slate roofs, well, they all have aesthetic advantages, and many offer good longevity. Again, caveat emptor, price and quality do not necessarily go hand in hand, depending on where you are buying and who is installing. Don't depend on the statements of the seller alone. Investigate. Do your homework. Find out from people who have had the identical material installed for a long time how it did for them. See what their experience has been. And if they'll allow it, go look at their roof. Climate factors can also impact a roof's effectiveness, and not just with ice dams. For example, in the hot weather and intense sun of places like Texas, asphalt and asphalt shingles will tend to melt into a really well-bonded roof that stays put, even despite the really heavy seasonal windstorms they get out there. Now, if you're like me and deep into technology, well, we all have our crosses to bear, but statistically, we tend to be less aware of the look, the decor, the cosmetics of a roof than we need to be if we ever intend to have anyone else living in or visiting the house beneath the roof. So, to avoid spousal distress, make sure that any new roof and anything you do on the roof has the right look to it. That has to do with the kind of roofing, the choice between scalloped or even edging, the color of the roofing, how much it looks like or doesn't look like neighboring roofs. Let a more decor-conscious spouse guide you in those choices. Beyond spousal issues, there may turn out to be an HOA or a zoning code involved, and it's a lot less expensive to know about those things ahead of time. Of course, the subject of roofing doesn't end at the edge of the roof. Those gutters are there, and we need to consider them. They can be made with a polymer in moderate climates or with aluminum or steel and sometimes more expensive metals. Some of the leaf-shedding gutter covers seem to work, and we've seen brushes that fit into the gutters that can also help keep leaves out. Whatever you choose for your gutters, if you have a drone, shooting drone video of the gutters is the fastest, safest way to inspect them and identify any limited number of places where you need to risk a trip up the ladder. One other note, just below the gutters, there are new products like those from OELO, I won't pretend to pronounce it, it's spelled OELO, that let you permanently mount decorative lighting that you can program for colors or animations reflective of, well, everything from holidays to your favorite team. So perhaps my strongest message about roofs is the one that happens in the attic, keeping the roofing board from getting warm with a thick layer, again, closed-cell polyurethane foam. That insulation will help prevent damaging ice dams. Remember, ice dams can mean ice damage, water damage too. And maybe my most useful tip is to use a drone to inspect your gutters because it's always a little dangerous to be shuttling around your ladder and going back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, November the 27th at 7 p.m., and topic of presentation is, of course, Cool Holiday Tech. They will meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer User Group, otherwise known as BCUG, has a presentation on current trends in personal technology Thursday, November the 29th. They will meet in the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society, also known as DACS, D-A-C-S, they will meet Tuesday, December the 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and their location of meeting is the Danbury Hospital Creasy Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on new technology toys for the holidays. Tuesday, December 4th, meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they'll meet at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting planned for Friday, December the 7th. 8 p.m. is the meeting time, and they will meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. NYU is in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have a meeting on Friday, December the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they meet in the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. The Westchester PC Users Group will be having a meeting on Thursday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is holiday gifting. They will meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or BAI.org streaming on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. Back up, and pretty please, back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.